This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Our look back at favorite shows of the year continues today. And with me in the studio now is producer Amber Nimmix. Amber, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We do this every year. About this time, we celebrate the work we did, and we give you a chance to hear some of the programs that you might have missed. Amber, most of your favorites were with authors, but first, we're going to talk about something that is completely different, hockey.
Yeah, Frank, we did a show in January of this year called Ice Fever, and we contemplated how the popularity of ice sports, especially Hurricanes hockey, has grown in the Triangle and all over North Carolina. And there are a lot of reasons that hockey is taking hold here, but one of them has to do with a certain professional wrestler.
All right, let's listen to Brian Hoyle, Canes announcer at the RBC Center, and to Ric Flair. That is the inimitable Ric Flair, who has become a kind of aural icon for the Canes.
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of the favorite things that I like to hear because that means we've just made something good happen on our side of the ledger. That goes back to that transition to move and to introduce the population to what hockey was going to be all about. Let's find something that they're familiar with and bring it inside the venue. And I remember a television campaign where they put the, just like a one of the race cars, the NASCARs, they stickered it up in the number 43 STP and engaged the services of Richard Petty, the king of racing. And, you know, this is the Ric Flair was something that was a natural that stayed with the club. When you hear that crowd of, you know, on a really good night when you've got 15, 16, 17,000 people in there and you hear that, woo, they really, I mean, it gets your blood going.
And Ric Flair, for those who don't know, is a professional wrestler, was. And so that's how you make that transition, a little segue from wrestling to what you know to what you may not know. And you've got a story, actually, about being in Helsinki and trying to.
Yeah, we went there to start the season this year. The regular season is part of the Copyware Premier Games. And the NHL brought the Hurricanes and the Minnesota Wild to Helsinki to start the season. It was a home-and-home event, and they had an in-game host who was the comparable, for those who've been to a Hurricanes game, he was the equivalent of our Ron the Ref, the in-game host who would work the crowd in the bowl. And he would help translate some of the in-game entertainment that Canes Vision puts together here in Raleigh. They brought it there, and he would translate. So he would start in English, but then he would explain. And hearing the in-game host, his name was Lowry Salavada. Lowry, that's mm-hmm. right. And he would explain to folks what the woo was all about. So if you hear a Hurricane's goal, and of course I'm translating from what I knew he was going to say, I couldn't understand a word of it, but explaining to the crowd what wooing was all about, and then explaining the difference between that and for the 300 Hurricanes fans who'd made the trip over there as well, he was explaining to the local fans, if you hear them ruing, which was a difference between the wooing, he was the ru. They're not booing, they're ruing. That was for Tuomo Ruutu, which the local fans, they're big fans of their native son. So they were explaining the concept of wooing at the end of a Hurricanes goal.
When you're in Finland, don't mess with your woos and your roos. You got to get that straight or you could be in trouble. And you said that the Finnish crowds were actually a lot different than what you'd see down there.
Yeah, they're very polite. I mean, it's a different hockey environment there with the international game that it took them a bit to kind of get the idea that when things got a little more physical than they were used to, that was okay. And so there was a different environment between the first game and the second game. It was night and day. And the crowd was very much more alive on that Friday night game, mm-hmm. which I believe the Hurricanes were the home team at that point. So they must have been rooting for us, I think.
Yeah. Well, you were able to distinguish the woos from the roos. So that's so that was Brian Hoyle, the Canes announcer at the RBC Center. Amber, you big hockey fan?
I can't say that I am. I never have. I can't see that puck. It's so small. I'm much raised on ACC basketball, and I have yet to be converted. But I have a lot of friends who grew up right here and have become hockey fanatics. So they've caught the fever.
Well, from the Taste of the New South on Ice, we're going back to remembering the South of the 1960s with my interview with Clyde Edgerton. Clyde's one of North Carolina's most prolific writers, and he came out with a new book this year, Night Train. It's about two young men, one black, one white. The African-American character loves Thelonious Monk, while the white character wants to be James Brown. Why did you pick this as one of your favorites, Amber?
Well, it was such a fun time watching Clyde in the studio just jamming out to James Brown. And he really did an amazing job of explaining how music fuels his imagination when he's creating, especially with this book. And plus, he told us a story that didn't make the book. And I love hearing from writers about what wound up on the cutting room floor.
It's hard to talk about the novel without divulging some of my biography. In 63, I joined a rock and roll band, and six white guys, one of whom wanted to be James Brown. And I've remembered that all my life, that experience of in fact, learning the album Live at the Apollo. We tried to learn it word by word, including the introduction of James Brown, note by note. my friend Dennis Hobby, I think lives in Charlotte, near Charlotte, no, in Atlanta now, comes out on stage with a cape on. He falls into the floor and he sings, for example, Please, Please, Please. And I could not help but remember the night that the rest of the band played a trick on him. When he fell into the floor, he was singing, Please, Please. And we're supposed to come in, don't, 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 don't. But we just stood there and let him say, Please, Please, yet again. And I did have that scene in the novel, but it ended up on the cutting room floor.
Well, you know, music does, and the rhythms of that time and that era reverberate and actually pound through this book. It's interesting because I read an interview that you did or heard one that talked about, that led me to another interview, Michael Tilson Thomas talking to James Brown. This is, and thank you, Clyde Edgerton, for turning me on to this, but it's an incredible interview.
It is an incredible interview, and I heard it while I was doing a little bit of research on James Brown. I came across it, and I got so excited about this interview, and it's the MTT Files number 7 that people can look for.
Oh, yeah. It's Michael Tilson Thomas talking to James Brown. It was about 8 months before Brown died, and Tilson Thomas clearly a fan of James Brown forever. And what's remarkable, the interview goes for an hour. I recommend it. Thank you, Clyde, for putting me onto it. And in the middle of this, there's this mashup, James Brown and Stravinsky. Let's listen.
It's absolutely mind-blowing. When I heard that and I was working on this novel, I said, this will be the title of my novel. I'm going to move a little ahead of my time. My publisher will have no problem letting the cover of my book say the title of this novel is A Sound and then have the link. It'll be a great PR. It'll be great
exactly.
PR. But unfortunately, I could see the looks when I proposed this, a raised eyebrow, or have you lost your mind? So it did not become the title of my novel, but that piece of music there is incredible.
It is The Night Train, and that is another James Brown song. And let's listen to that and why, and you can tell us why that inspired the title.
What's incredible about that is what Michael Tilson Thomas referred to, and that is the emphasis on the one beat, boom. Whereas in most rhythm and blues music, you've got the emphasis on the two and the four, boom, and that's what the old version of Night Train was, doom. And suddenly, in this version, we've got that boom, 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 on that one beat.
Yeah.
And Michael Tilson Thomas was so excited about that. And James Brown tried to talk about it, and they tried to talk about it together. But that's a good example of how innovative James Brown really was rhythmically and in other ways.
So that's Clyde Edgerton. And we heard from a listener about one of the characters in his new book, Night Train. Turns out the bleeder was inspired by a real musician who lived here in Durham. Let's listen to Clyde tell us about him.
Well, he comes from a memory also. In the late 50s, there was a jazz club in Durham at the corner, I think, of Chapel Hill and University. It was in a small room in the actually underground. in a building, and people would come in. My memory says Friday night. Some of the old-timers will remember this place, and there was a hemophiliac guy playing guitar, and we watched him over heads in the smoke, a pale fellow sitting there, just played incredible guitar. I know nothing else about it, but that memory made me need to do something with that, and I began to realize how I could work that in the story.
So who was the real-life bleeder?
Turns out his name was Harrison Register, and I traded emails with his brother, Charles. Harrison was a musician. He played in local clubs and all around town, which was where Clyde heard him when he was growing up. And one of the clubs that Harrison Register played in was a legendary Frog and Nightgown in Raleigh. And if I ever have a time machine, I'm going to dial it back to the Frog and Nightgown era of Raleigh, because I've heard so many stories about that club, and I would love to have been a fly on that wall. Harrison had severe hemophilia, as did the character in Clyde Edgerton's book. And his brother says that kept him in many ways from expanding his musical career. And he died in 1973.
All right, on the State of Things today, talking about favorites with producer Amber Nimix. When we come back, we're going to hear another Wilmington writer, Celia Rivenbark, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.
Don't go.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're taking a look back at the year that was. With me in the studio, producer Amber Nimix. Amber, what's next on the list?
Well, I couldn't talk about my favorites of this year without talking about Celia Rivenbark. Celia is a humor columnist. You can read her every week in the News and Observer. Her latest book is called You Don't Sweat Much for a Fat Girl. And that's a pretty good title, but I think she's had better ones. In fact, her first one was called Bless Your Heart, Tramp. And that's my favorite Celia Rivenbark title of all time. And it was shortly after that book came out that I met Celia, because I was her editor.
When was that?
I was features editor at the Wilmington Star News. That's where Celia got her start. She was a cub reporter, and then they turned her into a columnist. And they have been publishing her ever since. And her column was well established by the time I got there. And I was just kind of, as features editor, I was just in charge of making sure it got in the paper. But when I first got to the Star News, I didn't know who Celia was. And her copy turned up, and I said, well, I think it needs a little tweaking. And my assistant features editor, who had been there for a lot longer, said, I don't think you want to mess with Celia's copy. And I said, well, I just think this would be a little bit tighter and a little bit better. And I made the change on the fly, and it went in the paper, and I soon became acquainted with Celia.
Uh-oh, how was that?
Well, she was none too happy when she saw the version of her column in its modified form. And she let me know that she knew what funny was, and I was not to change her copy again. And so I didn't, and we've got along famously ever since. And the two of you got along quite well when she was on the show in August. So let's hear it.
Celia, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. I'm so glad to be back here.
It's great to have you back. Great to see that you're out with another book and another provocative title, You Don't Sweat Much for a Fat Girl.
Yeah, and actually the title, I cannot lie, came from an Andy Griffith episode that I treasured many years ago. And I think it was perhaps Andy trying to coach Otis on how to say sweet nothings. And so that, to Otis, was a sweet nothing. It didn't go well at all.
That was really on the show?
Yeah, really on the show. Mm.
But see, you've been at this a while now, and you've gained a certain measure of fame. We know you here in the Triangle and the greater Apex area. They're always talking about
this. The Triangle is very loyal to me.
How do you keep all that from going to your head?
Oh, I don't. I'm a total big head, complete jerk about it.
You traveled in pretty good circles. Now, here's the thing, kind of a sad story, because you tried to get David Sedaris to blurb your book.
I did. He's a terrible small man. No, he's not.
Well, yes, he won't do this show either.
Yeah. Oh, I feel better.
He's from Raleigh. And he's big fancy pants in France, lives in France.
Right.
Will not blurb your book. No, he won't do the show.
No. It was really stinky, too, because, and I write about this, I was the last person, I'd say the auditorium, it was at UNC Wilmington, huge crowd, standing room only, maybe a couple of thousand people. I was number 2,000. You know, I was the last one. I figured, you know, that he might be kind of weak by the time I got to him. So I held my little book in my sweaty little hands, and I said, oh, Mr. Sedaris, it would just mean the world to me. You know, just a blurb, it could change everything for me. And I love his work. And he just looked at me after I made my speech, and he said, no.
There you go.
And I was like, dude, let me down easy. You know, no, really? Is that the best you got?
Disappointing, unfortunate, of course. And you, both of you, really have personal connections here. He, mm-hmm. You know, he's got the rooster here in North Carolina. You got your Aunt Verly.
I do have Aunt Verly.
Tell us about her.
God bless her heart. Aunt Verly is the last of the great Southern women. Lee Smith always said, we just put our crazy people out on the front porch. We don't hide them. And Aunt Verly is a perfect example of that. My favorite story about Verly is that she gives all the women at Christmas. She's very crafty. So she makes little bedroom slippers for the women in the family using maxi pads that she glue guns little pink roses to. And I always say that they're actually pretty good looking, not to mention highly absorbent. So, you know.
Do you have an Aunt Verly? How much of her is a part of your real life?
Verly is probably, to be truthful, Verly is a composite of two aunts and a cousin. And they're all Verly.
Do they know this when they read your...
As I was saying earlier to a friend, the joy of being a Rivenbark from the country is none of my family knows how to read. So it's not really a problem. I can get away with all sorts of things. And they certainly never listen to lovely shows like this. You know, it's country music all the time.
So if they ever found out, would you be worried?
I would be worried, yeah, because they're all packing, you know. Yeah, I would worry.
Back in the trucks, Helia. Got a surprise for you. You have become active on Twitter.
I have. The publisher, I'm with St. Martin's and have been since, gosh, I guess 2000. And they are very into new media, which scares me to death. But I tweet now. And my tweets are quite a bit different from the weekly newspaper column and even the books. They're just a little randier, you know, which I really enjoy. I mean, it's 140 characters, but you can say a lot of really, really... really dicey stuff in 140
But it
characters.
Seems to me there's nothing more antithetical to a great Southern storyteller than 140 characters.
Good point. It was super hard at first. I mean, when I first tweeted, I thought it was 140 words. So I was like having the time of my life. And I went to file it or whatever you do, hit the little button, and the bird said, no, what are you talking about? You know, so I had to back. I was like, 140 letters? Are you serious?
Wow.
So it is confining. But on the other hand, it forces you to really, really concentrate on what's important.
Would you read for us? I'd love to hear something from the book, the new book. Celia Rivenbark is my guest. You don't sweat much for a fat girl, the latest collection.
Yeah, I would love to read something for you. And I'd like to read actually some of the first chapter, if that's okay with you.
Well, yeah.
And this is about, I started taking yoga class, which is pretty funny for a country girl, you know. I mean, yoga, what do we know from
they
yoga?
They even offer it where you live?
Yeah. Well, in Wilmington, which is, you know, a little bit more snooty, they do. And it's even at the art museum.
Oh.
So the downside of doing that is the school kids, they have buses of school kids coming there. And you got these, you know, old women with their butts in the sky, you know, along with the Surratt and the, you know, all the fancy paintings. So it's a little embarrassing when the school buses disgorge and there you are with your butt in the sky. But, so the first chapter, I do talk about my yoga experience, and I didn't really take to it like a lot of people do. I took it as a time where I could do nothing but lay down, perhaps go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't work. It just didn't work quite like the way I wanted it to. And so the instructor, when it was all over, she actually had to wake me up. And I said, I'm just never going to be one of those people that has the bumper sticker that says my other car is a yoga mat. I'm never going to be one of those people. But, you know, I did take my yard sale yoga mat, one that I'd borrowed from my friend. What I say here is that some of the women looked puzzled when I lay down and stayed down. But what can I tell you? It was the first time and for freaking ever that I'd had some me time, phone off, panties granny, and it felt absolutely wonderful. Laying there while the others practiced some serious deep breathing and challenging poses, I understood why everybody loves yoga. I went to sleep. It's absolutely true. And she
you really did?
I did, because it was so relaxing. And she nudged me with her foot at the end of class.
You stayed just the whole time? Because they do. I mean, there's a lot of downtime, but they do chat a little bit.
You know, they do. But I had told her repeatedly, perhaps upwards of 100 times, that I'd never done yoga before, because I wanted the bar to be set really low. But, you know, and I got interested because I read that Eat, Pray, Love. Do you remember that book?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Where the chick ate 11 pizzas in one day and just negated it all with yoga. Mm. So I'm like, all right, this is the answer for me, because I'm all about eating the 11 pizzas.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was a fun experience doing yoga. And I may go back one year.
You're kind of done with it, huh?
Well, you know, I'm kind of over it right now.
Celebrity experiences. We talked about David Sedaris, unfortunate celebrity experience there.
Yes.
And, you know, kind of nearly a hometown guy, fellow Tar Heel.
I thought, in fact, I pointed that out to him, you know. And I said, look, you can read it on the plane. And he's like, no.
Still no. Talked about tweeting. Actually, now, and followers, Kathy Ireland, supermodel turned furniture and diets spokesperson guru, used to follow you on Twitter.
She did follow me on Twitter. And I think it's one of those cases where every now and then a famous person, if you follow them, they automatically push a little button that follows you. It's really kind of sweet. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, most of them don't do that. But she's, you know, as I said, my tweets are a little edgy. And she's all about the, you know, being uplifting and incredibly boring.
Yeah. It seems a little more earnest than you would tolerate.
She's very earnest. Yeah. And every night when she tweets, she says, good night, sweet angels. And I'm like, what? You know, I got nothing in common with this woman, you know.
What was your last tweet? Do you remember?
I think I said that I was trying to give a expletive about women's soccer. Having a hugely hard time with that.
Your most exciting celebrity encounter was in Atlanta, I understand.
Yes, I actually went on, it was a book tour for You Can't Drink All Day If You Don't Start in the Morning. It was an Atlanta radio station, kind of a big one, you know, some are bigger than others, and had the giant parking lot, and the place was designed to look like Tara. And I noticed when we got there, there were all these cars backed in, all black Hummers, that sort of thing. And it was Fabolous, who is a great, great rapper, and who just, he had bodyguards aplenty and everything. It was so exciting. And I wanted to ask him for his autograph for my daughter, but he slept the whole time.
Wow.
He sat in his chair and he slept the whole time.
Does he do yoga? Maybe.
I rather doubt it.
You know, you're talking about, you've got health tips. I know you worked at yoga a little bit. It's going to be a while before you go back. You're also considering the difficult question of women of your particular age. So let me ask you what I ask all my guests.
Uh-huh.
How's menopause going?
It's not going well. It's not going well. The worst symptom of menopause is that I forget everything. I said this to someone today because it just happened. I am at the stage where I walk into a room and I forget why I'm there. And a lot of people do that. But when you walk into a room and you forget why you're there and the room has a big table, flat table with stirrups on the end, you should pretty much know that you're at the gynecologist's office, you know. But no, I space out constantly.
Going hard for you. Well, that you are also, I guess, because of these thoughts that are running through your head, you're actually contemplating your own funeral.
I am. And I am so excited because, I mean, I don't want it to happen next week or anything. But I don't know if you remember the movie Imitation of Life. Best funeral ever, okay? So I want, like, weeping and gnashing of teeth. I want the floral bearers throwing the flowers on the casket as it goes through the entire city of Wilmington, or perhaps New York, you know, if we're really thinking big. And I want people throwing themselves on the casket and screaming, no, if only it could be me. Doesn't that sound good?
Shouldn't we have our funeral before we die?
Well, if only.
I mean, just have a little, you know, like a party. Instead of a birthday party this year, let's do my funeral.
I think that's a fabulous idea, you know?
You have seen some great movies lately. We have a clip of one that you just could not seem to get enough of. Let's listen.
He may be the world's worst dog.
No, this was part of the plan.
No, it wasn't, but it's so much better.
But he brings out the best in their family.
A dog doesn't care if you're rich or poor. Give him your heart, and he'll give you his.
Well, there we go. That is a film that you saw and you didn't like.
Marley and Me.
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't really understand. I just, and I know this is going to really hurt the feelings of dog people, and I'm real sorry about that, but he should have died a lot earlier. I'm just going to say it. You know what? I mean, he tripped the toddler. The toddler had the big, you know, big hematoma on his head. You know, he tore up all the sofa cushions. There's feathers flowing everywhere. I said in the book, I would have to be sedated if I walked in on a scene like that. You know, I can't handle it. I just don't do the whole dog thing.
The best, I think the best films about dogs are ones where they die. But maybe earlier is better. Sudie Rivenbarks, you don't sweat much for a fat girl. Would you read another section for us?
I would. There's a chapter, and I got a tremendous response to this when I wrote about it in the newspaper, and I tapped into something. I wasn't sure if I was the only one who had noticed it. I watch the Food Network a lot, and there's a couple on the Food Network called the Neelys. And they do Down Home. In fact, it's Down Home with the Neelys. Very fabulous soul food. Food's great. I can't complain about that. But basically, they spend the entire half hour needing very much a room. And so it's unbelievable. So I have a chapter called A Marriage in Three Acts. In the third act of our marriage play, allow me to vent just a moment about a couple that may love each other a little too much. Please tell me that I'm not the only person who thinks Pat and Gina Neely, the nauseatingly in love stars of Food Network's Down Home with the Neelys, need to get a room with a velvet swing, mirrors, and plenty of oils that aren't Crisco. Pat and Gina Neely host a cooking show, but they baby talk, kiss, and cuddle so much it's a wonder anything gets cooked. And yes, I could turn it off, but then I'd miss the only soft porn I get all week. Plus, I'm incapable of turning off a show that promises a recipe for mac and cheese topped with strips of bacon and crushed potato chips. Incapable. So the food is fabulously, decadently Southern, but the banter? Well, this is only a slight exaggeration. Pat, today Gina and I are going to make some barbecue ribs that'll set your mouth on fire. Gina, you set my mouth on fire, baby. Ooh, ooh. Pat, oh girl, when you talk like that, I can't remember whether I put the vanilla extract in the sweet potatoes or not. Gina, baby, I'm the only sweet you need. Come over here and give me some sugar. Camera nervously lingers on a pan of mashed rutabagas languishing by the sink while sounds of, baby, baby, come from somewhere near the mixmaster. Pat, and we're back. It's time to stuff that duck. Gina, you're the only duck I want to stuff. Pat, baby, I don't even know what that means, but it sounds like it might be hot. Gina, Pat, come over here and watch me lick this spoon. Pat, girl, I wish I was that spoon. Gina, to camera, my husband's so bad, isn't he, ladies? You know I like to keep my man happy, and one way I do that is with my creme brulee. Pat, was that French? Because, baby, you know I like French. French toast, French fries, French kisses. Put that turkey dressing pan down, girl, and get on over here. Gina, down, boy. We have to keep our minds on what's cooking. Pat, I'd hit that. What? Pat, oh, sorry, I was just daydreaming about the time I first saw you back in middle school, and you were so fine, and my best friend Rodney asked me what I thought of you. Gina, Pat, that's enough sexy talk for one day. This butternut squash isn't going to saute itself now, is it? Pat, I'd like you to butter my nuts. Hasty commercial break. Now they come back. Gina's visibly disheveled. And we're back. And whoa, who's that at the door? Why, it's Pat's nosy butt mama again. Nosy butt mama, y'all cutting the fool up in here again? And then to Pat, I told you this trifling heifer was going to be the death of you. Gina, why, you old. Pat, separating the two women, join us next time when mama shows Gina how to clean the oven by sticking her head in it with the gas on. Mama, you sure that's safe? Nosy butt mama, oh yes, honey, it's the only way.
Celia Rivenbark reading from You Don't Sweat Much for a Fat Girl. You get a lot more out of that show than I do.
Oh, you got it. I tell you, it's just there for the taking.
It's great. Listen, I know that you have a proposal that I think is a great idea.
Do you really?
I think it's time. I mean, Garrison Keillor has been a mainstay of public radio a long, long time, an enormously talented guy. Mm-hmm. But you know, there comes a time. And
everything
you have a plan.
I have a super-duper plan, and I'm determined to pitch it to the folks at NPR that have power about these things. And what I want to do is move at least the news from Lake Wobegon to Lake Wiley or Lake Jordan or just some local lake, you know. So instead of all those Minnesota tundra jokes, Powder Milk Biscuits can sponsor my show from right here in North Carolina. And I can do the different vignettes from a community where all the women are strong. I'll do that. All the men are good looking and all the children are above average. I can make the move. So News is probably my favorite part of the show, keeping everybody updated on the curious comings and goings of a tiny imaginary community of eccentrics and herring eaters, but then I repeat myself. I'd keep the format the same, but there would be no more visits to the Chatterbox Cafe for tuna hot dish, because that sounds nauseating. But here's something. Here's my pitch. I would say something like, because I've been practicing how they talk, and I think I can do it. It's been quite a week here on Lake Wylie. Old Mrs. Katzenbaum had bunion surgery that everyone at the WMU had told her for years to stop putting off. But she said Mr. Katzenbaum would never be able to take care of himself if she was off her feet. So she just kept delaying the surgery until her sister agreed to drive down from Roanoke and help out a little. Mr. Katzenbaum was very happy about this. Because his sister-in-law makes a better banana pudding than any of the wives who send dishes to the Lake Wylie Sons of Desperation potluck and pinatas event. Avery Whippet gives his shirt an extra puff of spray starch when he hears that Mrs. Katzenbaum's sister is coming to town. For years now, he's admired her from afar. Once he got close enough to smell her, a heady mix of Lilt Home Permanent Solution and Jimmy Dean's sage sausage patties. See, that's just 30 seconds of material.
That
I'm already
fantastic.
Good to go.
Folks, write today to NPR and take up that proposal.
You think?
Well, then, news from Lake Wylie.
Yeah,
why not?
There's no reason why not.
If you promise not to sing, I will write in your support.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That sounds great. You will not hear any of that or read it in Celia Rivenbark's new book, but you will read plenty of funny stuff. You don't sweat much for a fat girl. Celia, thanks so much for being
Thank
on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Southern humor writer Celia Rivenbark talking with me from earlier this year. When we come back, we'll hear from another Southern writer, Tom Franklin, who's funny, but not always on purpose. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, taking a look back now at some of our favorite shows from the past year. Today's picks from producer Amber Nimix. Amber, your final choice was author Tom Franklin. What made you pick him?
Well, I really loved his book, Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. And I kind of expected him to be sort of a reserved man of letters. You know, from reading his book, you always have an idea of the picture of the author in your head. And so when he got into the studio, he was so self-effacing and honest and just the whole, you know, the funniest story on himself. And it has to be the funniest sad story I think I heard this whole year.
It really was a sad story.
But it was so funny at the same time.
It was great. You didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And we were live. Mm-hmm. All right, here's Tom Franklin, author of Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter.
Yeah, it's how Southern children are taught to spell Mississippi. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter, crooked letter I, humpback I. So crooked letters are S's and humpbacks were P's.
So you have established yourself as a Southern writer right off the bat. The place is now
very important,
whether you like it or not. The title is a reference to the book's setting. There were other reasons for choosing that, though, weren't there?
There were. I thought it was such a great title in the first place. It was surprising to me that no one had used that for a book title. You know, there are very few good book titles left. So I was writing the book originally to be set in Alabama, as my other three books are. But when I considered that title, I thought I got to move it to Mississippi. It sounded like a crime novel to me, and it sounded like Elmore Leonard might have written it. So I'm proud of the title. I'm happy with it.
Because it would have been a hockey stick. You know, it just wouldn't – you'd have been stuck for sure. Tell me about the two characters who inhabit this book, Scary Larry Ott and Silas 32 Jones.
Yeah, Scary Larry is a mechanic's son who is not popular in school and has few friends in the first place until Silas Jones moves to town. He moves there with his mother. And they have a kind of secret friendship. And actually, the character of Scary Larry is based very much on me. Many of his the events in his past are events from my past, and I did have a secret black friend for a while. So a lot of this is autobiographical. But for Silas, who is the black character, Silas, his nickname is 32 Jones. He came from somewhere else entirely. I was writing this book about two white characters. And a friend of mine, David Wright, who is African-American, actually has written a book about the Outer Banks called Fire on the Beach. David and I were talking about this book one night years ago, and I was complaining about how hard it was to write it. I didn't quite know what the story was yet. And I said, it's about a mechanic with no customers and a small-town police officer. And David said, why don't you make the small-town cop a black guy? And I said, oh, well, I hadn't thought of that. And you know, it made me nervous to consider writing from a black man's point of view. But he said, I'll help you. And he read it for me. And you know, without him, I don't think I would have tried that.
Well, tell us about that collaboration and trying to inhabit a black character.
Well, I found it to be very hard, and you know, I began to look at how I wrote white characters differently, and in fact, looked very closely. One thing I noticed is, as writing from a white man's point of view, whenever that character would notice another character, another white man, he would be identified as a man. You know, he saw a man approaching. But if it were a black man, he would identify the other race. You know, he saw a black man approaching. So I reversed that for Silas. He saw a man, or he saw a white man. That was. I think the very surface way that I began to do it. And I thought about it a lot and ultimately remembered a story that David had told me, David Wright had told me. He and I met in Illinois. We both taught at Knox College there in Galesburg, Illinois. And he convinced my wife and me to use the maid that he and his wife used. And she was a white woman. I said, great, you know, we'll try a maid. We'd never had a maid before, and I felt a bit of guilt about it. You know, I should clean up my own messes. But you know, eventually we tried his maid. And we liked her. And at one point, David and I were talking in a bar at night, and he said, does she do your toilets? And I said, yeah, why? He said, she won't do ours. And I thought, okay, you know, David feels this a lot, probably, and things that I wouldn't have even imagined, he would notice. So that helped me a bit. And but eventually, I just stopped thinking about it and wrote Silas as a man with, you know, without worrying about it. And when I finished the book, when I drafted it, I sent it to David, who found probably 11 or 12 places where I got race wrong. You know, they were all nuanced things. For example, Silas's mother, Alice, you know, I had her thinking and using one, I think I had her think colored. And David said, no, she would probably think black. She's a bit older, and colored wasn't really used at that point. Hmm. So things like that he really helped me with.
And Silas Jones, the black character, is the constable, another regionalism. I don't know if we have many constables these days up this way, but maybe we do. I might get a phone call in a minute. He's the white character, Larry Ott, Scary Larry, has a shadow that hangs over him. Tell us about that.
Larry had one date in his life. He took a neighbor girl to the drive-in movie, and she's never seen again. And this paints his whole life for him.
He's never convicted?
He's never convicted or indicted, and he never confesses. So, and nobody's found, so he's just left to live his life alone. But as a pariah, no one will speak to him. In Walmart, the clerks look at him funny. Everyone knows who he is. When he orders KFC, the girls are rude to him, and you know the clerks are rude to him.
Now, interestingly enough, you said that Larry is the character your life parallels Larry's, and you had an episode very much like this one.
Absolutely. My first date, she and I were going to the drive-in, and on the way she told me, I need to see my boyfriend. And her boyfriend was a big guy, played football. And she told me that her parents would only let her date me because her parents knew my parents, and they thought I was safe, and I probably was. I certainly wasn't, you know, any Scary Larry. But instead of taking one to the drive-in with her, I took her to her boyfriend's house, dropped her off, and went to the drive-in by myself.
Now, this was at her request, we should point out, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't your idea.
No. In the book, she sends Larry to the drive-in by her. That's her order. In real life, I had nothing else to do. I had 4 hours to kill, and I couldn't go home because my parents were really thrilled that I finally had a date. I was 16. I never had a date. They were worried about me. So I just couldn't go home. I was too embarrassed, and I really couldn't drive around for 4 hours. So I went to the drive-in and parked at the front where the kids usually, where families parked, hoping no one would notice me. But of course, I'd bragged about the date a little bit, and a friend pulled in behind me just as it was getting dark. And you know, and I knew what went on at the drive-in movie because my brother and I had gone to this drive-in since I could drive every weekend because they showed R-rated movies. And we could see nudity, and we liked that, you know, ages 16 and 14. And I had plans to, you know, get lucky that night at the drive-in. You know, I'd park back in the back by the trees, and the windows would fog up. So when my friend pulled in behind me, I took a blanket I'd brought just in case and put it over my hand as if it were my date's head. and held it up there in silhouette. I hoped it looked like a person sitting beside me in the car.
Tom Franklin, that is the saddest story I've ever heard in my life.
You know, I tell it a lot, and actually it gets big laughs. And I tried to write it. I tried to write it as an essay, and I couldn't write it. I told it so many times that I couldn't make it funny on the page.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with Larry, what happens to him? He takes the girl to her. He doesn't know who he takes her to see. He takes her and drops her off and goes to the drive-in by himself and leaves. And when he comes back, he never sees her again. No one ever sees her again. So that's not funny. And so it became very serious, which I'd never considered. I'd never considered making it serious.
Would you read for us?
I will. This is a part. This is from 32's point of view. He is coming back from patrol, and he sees a bunch of buzzards, and he's looking for a body. So he's gonna follow the buzzards. He picked his way along the water's edge, setting off a series of bullfrogs from the cattails and reeds. Cane Creek was more like a slough, he thought. It hardly moved at all, its blackberry water stirred only by the wakes of frogs, or bubbles from the bottom, or bloops the fish made. Among floating leaves and dark black sticks, liquor bottles and their reflections, and faded beer cans and theirs, had collected in coves and turns, and he wondered who the hell would come all the way out here to litter. He fanned his face again, insects like toy planes propellering madly through the high branches. Might just be a bobcat, he thought, come down to the creek to die. That old instinct, hurt, head for water. He thought of his mother, dead 8 years, the time the two of them lived in a hunting cabin on land owned by a white man. No water in the place, no electricity, no gas. There'd been squatters there for less than a week when a one-eared tomcat appeared on the porch just past dark. They shooed it off, but morning found it lying on the steps with a mouse twitching in its jaws. My lord, his mother said, that cat's applying for a job. They hired it, and it insinuated itself all the way onto his mother's bed, where she said it warmed her feet. They moved from that cabin a few months later, and the cat moved with them. It would live with them for years, but then, just before he left to go to Oxford his senior year, the cat disappeared. By the time he noticed, his mother said it had been gone nearly a month. Where? Just off, baby, she said. Off? She was washing clothes in the sink, still in her hairnet from work. To die, Silas, she had said. When an animal's time comes, it goes off to die.
Tom Franklin reading from his new novel, Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. Where did the idea for the story come from?
Well, from a few places. I never know what a story is going to be when I start or a novel is going to be when I start. I have an image or an idea. In this case, it was several years in the making. I in 2003, had a vague notion to write a book about brothers. My brother, Jeff, is a mechanic, and he and I are very close but very different in every way. And I'm interested in the idea of people who are different but connected. I stopped writing that book or this book at one point to write my second novel called Smunk, and that took a couple of years in the middle. So then I came back to this one. At that point, the idea had changed, and I'd become interested in the small-town mechanic with no customers. There's a certain garage that I know of, and I passed it hundreds of times, and there's never a customer in the bay door. It's just and the mechanic sits there by himself, and I always found that really fascinating. What does he think in there? What does he do in there?
That's the second saddest story I've ever heard.
And the other idea was, what was a small town police officer. There's plenty of urban cop stories, and not as many small town. And I grew up in Dickinson, Alabama, which itself was a hamlet. I didn't know that until I read Faulkner's The Hamlet. But it's this tiny, it's just a store. It's what Dickinson was. That store is now closed. But cop was from nearby Fulton, and Dickinson was in his jurisdiction. His name's Larry Hicks. He's still there. He's a deputy now. Now there's two of them. But I was fascinated by Larry. He would ride through Larry Hicks. He would ride through our hamlet a couple times a day, and I found it very interesting. And so those two ideas, I thought first the mechanic was the whole story, and the missing girl was coming back, and she was the one, would be the other character. And then then the cop kept insinuating himself. So eventually I realized the two of them were the story.
This is your first foray into mystery or crime novel?
Yes.
Was it difficult for you to write a crime novel?
You know, I didn't write it as a crime novel. I suppose I knew because of the title, it sounded like a crime novel. And the writers I was reading, George Pelicanos, Dennis Lehane, Richard Price, those guys write crime novels. So, I guess it was difficult because at some point it occurred to me, I've got two missing girls in this book and someone had to have done away with them. And I got to figure out who that was. So that plot point stuck me for a while. You know, but my first book, Poachers, has a long story, its title story, that won an Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Mystery Story. I had no idea that story was a mystery. I mean, I think all stories have mystery at their heart, and all good, you know, a good story should have mysteries at their heart. But I didn't know, and, you know, they called me from New York and said, you should come to the Edgars. And I said, well, I don't, you know, what's that? It's a mystery award. And I said, well, I don't write mysteries. They said, come anyway. So I did, and it's been fun. And then my second book, first novel, Hell at the Breach, is historical. It's set in the 1890s in Alabama. So, you know, I was first a Southern writer, then I was a mystery writer, then I was an historical writer, and now with Crooked Letter, I'm a crime writer. And I think that crime writing encompasses a lot of different categories like mystery and thriller and so on. And a friend of mine is Otto Penzler, who owns a mysterious bookshop in New York and edits Best American Mystery Stories. And his definition of a crime story or a crime novel is a novel that opens with a crime, which mine certainly does. Right. By that definition, Crime and Punishment is a crime novel, he says.
You know, you talked about being labeled a Southern writer. This book certainly has that key characteristic. The place is a character in your book.
I hope
interesting,
so, yes.
Interestingly enough, you weren't in that place when you were in Brazil, weren't you?
Right, yeah, yeah. My wife's a poet. Her name's Beth Ann Fennelly, and she won a Fulbright to Brazil a couple of years ago to study the poet Elizabeth Bishop and took the whole family, me and our two kids at that time. We have three now. And I had 6 months with nothing to do but write, and that's how I finally got this book done. And also, being down in South America, writing about the American South was a strange situation. And I think that's why the character of Larry Ott is so autobiographical, because I was down there living in memory. You know, normally I write about the place where I'm living, Alabama or Mississippi, and I can walk around and I can experience the landscape. I can, you know, smell the trees and describe those things, you know, or see one of those locust husks on the side of a tree, and that'll get something, that'll kick something off in my head, and I can go and use that and, you know, and put it somewhere. Down there, the landscape, of course, is very different. And I think just using so much memory, I got in there, muddied up the water, and just suddenly think so many things about Larry Ott and me were the same. We're both mechanic sons. We're both obsessed with Stephen King as kids. I still am. I'm kind of obsessed with. I love Stephen King's work, and nearly every event, except for the fact that my first date didn't disappear, is similar with Larry and me.
Did that give you being away, being in a different location, give you permission to be more autobiographical?
I think it did. Yeah. I think also getting away gives you perspective in a way. You know, I grew up in Alabama and left and moved north to Arkansas for graduate school when I was 30. And that perspective helped me, you know, to see Alabama differently and I think more kindly. You know, I'd been not happy about a lot of things that have gone on there. But leaving and I'd go to Arkansas and I would tell them all my weird stories about growing up as a Southerner. And they would say, you should write that. You know, you've had a strange life.
And a sad one.
Yeah.
But sadly successful, but happily successful, I should say. Tom Franklin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
That was author Tom Franklin talking about his book, Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. And those were the favorite shows in 2011 from producer Amber Nimix. Amber, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Frank.
And thank you for listening. If you have a comment about the show or want to hear an archived edition of a past program, our website is stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.